This is lesson number 33 in our soteriology course. It is the beginning of the second year in our Bible Institute of Correspondence in the soteriology section of study. It is the beginning also of the third semester. I want to take a moment to introduce the section of study that we have here due to the fact that it is the beginning of the semester and also due to the fact that summarization is frequently quite beneficial to us. The first thing I want to do in this lesson is to take a look at the road behind us, take a moment to think about the things that we have covered, and then I want us to look at the format of study that we have used in the preceding portion and the one that we will continue to use in the following portion of this study. Thirdly, I want us to look at the road ahead of us and just to get an idea of what we intend to cover within the next semester and actually the semester following that. By way of review, you remember that you have already had 32 lectures in the soteriology section of the study alone. In the entire portion of the study, you've had 128 lectures up to this point. In the previous lessons on soteriology, we hope that we have erected a cornerstone and that you have some kind of a direction or a view of the direction in which we're going. I trust that as you study this, you will not feel that you are obliged to agree with everything that I teach. The idea of true study is not to seek out all of the things that we believe and agree with, or the things that accommodate our opinions, but they are to study, to learn, to see what the Bible teaches. And sometimes one of the very best ways to do that is to hear something of what other men believe the Bible teaches, and in some cases that's going to involve teaching in areas that we ourselves may not particularly agree with. Now, as we begin to study this, we look back and we remember that we have learned some things about man. First of all, we've learned that man is a created being. Now, the fact that he is a created being may sound insignificant. It may be considered something that is a given, and because we agree with it, we do not contest it in our mind, we don't see it as being terribly, terribly important. That'll be one of the greatest mistakes you'll ever make in the study of soteriology. You see, when we state that man is a created being, we are confessing that there is a creator. When we say, then, that there is a creator and that there is a creature produced by that creator, we suggest that that creator is therefore the owner. Not only so, but when we think of that creator as being the sovereign God of heaven, who worketh all things after the counsel of his own will, then we say that whatever man's salvation may be, whatever his punishment may be for sin, if there is such a thing as sin, whatever God's purpose for him is, we have confessed that it is the creator of heaven and earth who has the right to do with his creature whatsoever he pleases, and that he has the ability, being the sovereign God of heaven, to do as he pleases. So this issue of creation is extremely important in the study of soteriology. Not only have we learned that man is a created being, but we have learned what he is as a fallen creature, that he is not what God created him as in the strictest sense. Though God has left him still that same creature, but only with modified attributes and desires because of the fall. We use the term fall. We say that we all believe in the fall. And I suppose everybody believes in the fall in some sense. I don't know of anybody that thinks that man and woman are still living in the Garden of Eden. But on the other hand, there's a great deal of disagreement and a great deal of misunderstanding about what man is as a fallen creature. So we tried to learn in the previous lessons, the previous year, what man is as a fallen creature. We dealt with his guilt, and that is extremely important. Man is not just a victim of the fall, he is guilty of the fall. He did not transgress God's commandment because he had involuntarily fallen from the position in which God put him. But the Bible teaches in the New Testament, whatever we may or may not understand about it, the Bible clearly teaches that Adam by transgression fell. That's extremely important. We learned something concerning his nature as a fallen creature. That is to say that when man fell, he didn't just lose privileges, but that his nature changed. His very attributes were modified. His appetites were modified. We learned something concerning his ability. We found that in that fall, his abilities were modified. We experience that we cannot do all of the things that we purpose to do. We learn that we cannot even will all of the things that we would like to. We do not have total control of our own will. What a great thing it would be if I could say, I am just going to purpose that in the future I will never will to eat after I've had sufficient. I'll stop there. I will not want any more. But I often do, as many other people do. And we understand that we do not have the control of our will. We do not have the control of our appetites that we ought to have. So our ability has been modified. We learned something else, too. We learned that the modification of our ability did not alter our responsibility. That we are still responsible to all of the things that God has told us to do. And the fact that we have, as men, modified our ability by transgression and fall does not remove the responsibility. You may have heard someone say, God will never command you to do something that you don't have the ability to do. That person knows nothing about what they're discussing. God has said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might. And man in his fallen state finds himself insufficient for that task. He has told us, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. You find yourself unable to do that. But that inability does not remove your responsibility. Your responsibility is what God has told you to do. It is defined and delineated by what God has told you to do, not by what you are able to do. So we have learned something of what man is as a fallen creature. And then we spent a considerable amount of time in dealing with his volition or his free agency. This is an area of extremely fuzzy thinking. For instance, there are those who will try to claim or will claim in some way that man really has no volition, that he is like a stick or a stone, that he is passive in all of the things around him. Of course, they're wrong. Every creature that has intelligence has something of a will. And God has a will. We are created in the image of God. Though that image has been marred greatly by the fall, we still definitely have a volition or a will. To say free will is something like saying willing will. The will, in a definite sense, is free. But it is free only to act within the limitations of the nature of that creature whose will it is. For instance, we are not free to will to will. Now, that may sound extremely silly, but I mentioned a moment ago my desire to continue eating good food after I had eaten sufficient. And many times I have said, now I just need to get control of my appetite. And I do. I control my eating a lot more than most people would imagine. And by doing so, I control my weight to a great extent. However, it is not uncommon for me to really wish at 8 or 9 o'clock at night that I had a bowl of ice cream. I would like to get up and get a bowl of ice cream or a sandwich or anything like that. I could get up and eat fried chicken and enjoy it greatly. I don't do that because if I do, my weight skyrockets. But I cannot. I have not been able at this point to just say, all right, I will control my will to the point that I will not want to do that. That's the great protection against violating my program of diet, is just not to want it. So I'm going to just exercise my will in such a way that I will not desire things that are not good for me. Well, the fact of the matter is I've never been able to do that, and I don't know of anyone that has. We've discussed the free agency of man at great length, and it is a legitimate subject. It's an interesting subject, and it's a very, very important subject. Then I gave you an overview of the two basic philosophies of soteriology. Now, as we move on into this semester, we're going to continue the study of that. And so it's very important that we understand what we're talking about when we say two different philosophies. I've often said that there are only two real philosophies of soteriology or of salvation. One is grace plus whatever else religion may add to it. And that is has all kinds of different roads that it takes, but it always adds something to the grace of God. And the other philosophy is salvation by pure grace. However, it should be remembered and it should be mentioned that within those two philosophies, that is to actually be more accurate to say, within each of those philosophies is a very broad area of division. For instance, there are men who believe that man is saved totally by grace. But when he begins to define what he means by being saved totally by grace, he will move sometimes all the way out to the outer limits of total grace and, in essence, deny that a man is saved by total grace. In other words, he will say, man is saved by total grace if only he will do this. And, of course, he has denied totally the idea that man is saved by grace alone. And so those two philosophies are commonly defined as Calvinism and Arminianism. Now, I believe it's a mistake for us to refer to men carelessly as Calvinists or Arminians, because so many times these terms have been redefined to the point that they are very, very poorly understood. For instance, I've heard men say, are you a Calvinist? The answer to that question should always be, what do you mean by a Calvinist? And so when you ask that question, it has come to be a popular answer for a man to say, do you believe what Calvin believes? Now, that's absolutely erroneous as far as soteriological study is concerned. The term Calvinism was never academically a term to indicate that a person was in basic agreement with Calvin, even on all soteriological issues. For instance, there are men down through the ages who have call themselves Calvinists, who did not believe in infant baptism by 100,000 miles. Calvin believed in infant baptism. Calvin believed in a universal church. He believed in a holy Catholic church. He was an amillennialist, as far as I'm able to tell. There are just many areas that Calvin didn't even come close to believing the things that are defined as Calvinism. Calvinism is only a theological term. It essentially addresses nothing in Calvin's beliefs except the areas of soteriology. And in that area of soteriology, it is the idea that salvation is by grace alone. I question that John Calvin believed that at all. I doubt that John Calvin believed that at all. So these terms are sometimes very, very inaccurate, and it's important that we take time to understand them. Arminianism, once again, is only a theological term. It is named by after a man by the name of James Arminius, but James Arminius didn't originate it at all. It did not exist during his lifetime. The term came from a group of five doctrinal arguments that was put together by a group of men called the Remonstrants. Originally, this was put together about a year after Arminius died. And later than that, I think within 5 years, it was modified to become far more Pelagian than it was in the beginning of their structure. But these men went far beyond what Arminius believed. The fact of the matter is that James Arminius taught in the University of Holland in Amsterdam, same place where John Calvin had taught, and would never have been allowed to even teach there if he did not claim to essentially embrace the doctrines that Calvin embraced. And so the terms have become greatly exaggerated and misunderstood. But theologically, the term Arminianism is intended to believe or intended to describe those who believe in salvation by grace, but based upon conditions of human conduct that in some way merit or maintain that grace. So when we look at that, remember they're only theological terms, and remember that if you define the term yourself, if you set out to give it your own definition, all you will do is to fool yourself as to what the issues of study are. And even if you have the right conclusions, you couldn't put the right names on them because you've already confused the issues of definition. I tried to show how these two systems are different treatments of the same issues. Now, you often hear people say he is a five-point Calvinist. If you ask what those 5 points are, many times they will not know. Sometimes they're very harsh toward a, quote, five-point Calvinist and don't even know what the 5 points are. I've seen that often. Those 5 points are defined by an acronym, TULIP, T-U-L-I-P. And again, those doctrines are subject to a great deal of discussion. Let it be remembered that the 5 points did not originate with the Calvinistic philosophy. They originated with Arminianism. Negatively, the Remonstrants wrote concerning 5 things that they believed were errors being taught in the University of Holland at Amsterdam. That was their focus of their disagreement, that those things should not be being taught at that in the university. And even Arminius would not have openly at least openly, and perhaps not at all, would not have supported the grievances that the Remonstrants wrote about this. The term TULIP did not exist at that time, and the origin of that certainly was not with John Calvin. It was not with James Arminius. But the issues, those five issues, originated with the Remonstrants. The acronym probably had its origin in the United States with Princeton theologians, but it is not certain that that's the case. In other words, it's difficult to find, impossible, I think, to find reference to it before that time, to the acronym. But the fact of the matter is that it did exist along about that time, and it is thought that some theologian there used that to teach the students how to remember these things. But I spent some time trying to show the origin of that. I then spent some time on the doctrine of total depravity and showing, and of course, as you look at the TULIP, you understand that the T stands for total depravity. Now, in the last generation, there have been some men who have changed the name of that, and they've used the term total inability. Now, certainly, depravity has something to do with ability. But if we change the term that way to emphasize an objection that we have to a particular branch or division of that doctrine, then we're actually fooling ourselves as to what the issue is. We must remain static on what the claims were before we either affirm or deny our position on those. The T stood for total depravity, and I spent a considerable amount of time on the in the area of total depravity. The U stands for unconditional election. Now, that term is poorly misunderstood today, or poorly understood, very well misunderstood. But in its statement, it was not intended to claim that there were no conditions that God placed upon election, but rather that there was no revealed condition. That is to say, that we could not say that God chose because he looked out into the future, or because that is the theory of election according to foreseen faith, or the theory of election and time, that God chose us because we believe. They're saying that these conditions are not the cause of election. We spent a considerable amount of time on that, and that's essentially where we are at the present point, the present time in our study. Let's look then for a little bit at the format of our study for this semester and then the three semesters that shall follow it. There are six semesters in the Institute. We have completed two. This is number three. We are not yet quite halfway through then. And so when this is completed, this semester, we will be halfway through. And so this will be the format of study as we move on. This year, that is the next two semesters, we're going to continue in the direction of the TULIP acronym, or that pattern of our study. Now, the pattern as such, this is very fundamental that you get this truth in your mind. At least as far as the way I am presenting this, and I think this is an accurate presentation of it, the TULIP acronym as such neither denies nor affirms any of the doctrines that we're dealing with here. I mentioned a moment ago that the 5 points originated with the Remonstrants, who were students and followers of James Arminius. Arminius was essentially a modernist or a compromiser in these areas, and though he would never have denied or been allowed as the professor where he taught to deny these doctrines, he continually compromised them, thus producing the students that finally denied them. These are clear divisions. The TULIP are clear divisions of soteriological discussion about which everyone believes something. Now listen to what I'm saying. These are clear divisions of soteriological study about which everyone believes something. Everyone believes something about the degree of human depravity. Everyone believes something about the conditions or the lack thereof of election. If they know anything about the Bible, they will not deny some kind of election. They will discuss only the conditions or the lack thereof surrounding election. The L stands for limited atonement. Once again, the issue there is one about which everyone believes something. And even though there are a lot of people who would vehemently deny what I'm about to say, almost every Bible student in the world believes that atonement is in some way limited. The only person who does not believe that is the universalist, who believes that everyone will be saved. But atonement is reconciliation, and no evangelical believes that everyone is reconciled to God. Everyone who believes that there is a place called hell and that some people will ultimately go there believes in some kind of limitation on atonement, whether it is that those people who are unbelievers will not ultimately be purged from their sins by the blood of Christ for whatever cause. They believe something about a limitation upon atonement. We'll be discussing that. There's a great deal of misunderstanding, a great deal of false accusation, a great deal of argument about issues that are not the issue, but that needs to be discussed. The I stands for irresistible grace, and we're going to be talking about that I in this acronym. That's going to be part of our study as we go on. Then, of course, the P stands for preservation and perseverance of the saints. Now, I've heard good men say, I don't believe in perseverance of the saints. I believe in preservation of the saints. But to say that is to say I believe in a preservation that does not preserve, because perseverance is, in the teaching of the men who believe that, perseverance is the result of that preservation. It is not a condition of the preservation. It is not a teeter-totter or a counterbalance of the preservation, but it is rather the result of God preserving. So to make a statement like that is, in essence, to confess I have not really studied the issue at all. They, of course, would not confess that, but that's what they're confessing. So as we look at these 5 points, we have learned that they were not an argument for the doctrines of so-called Calvinism, but rather against those doctrines, and we're going to be considering that. As we look at this road ahead of us, we will first of all move to the doctrine of atonement. This doctrine is the very theme of the Bible. It's not always called that. Many times when it is called that, it is not defined at all, and more frequently, it is improperly defined, but the doctrine of atonement is in essence the theme of your whole Bible. It is the focus of all soteriological study, and we will be approaching that in the coming lessons. We'll spend many, many lessons on the doctrine of atonement. And I hope that we can help you to see this in such a way that you will not hate or disdain or renounce the man who disagrees with you on it, because it is a doctrine of sufficient difficulty to have arrested the minds of sincere students down through the ages. And only the person who looks at this carelessly and lightly, or the person who has a mind that can just discount issues of great reality, will come to this in a cocky and proud spirit. This doctrine of atonement is one with a great deal of diversity of theory, not only as to what the name should be for these various divisions of doctrine, but exactly what is involved in atonement. Does atonement involve only the washing away of the sins of the elect, or are there other things involved in atonement? Does atonement cover such things, for instance, as forbearance? Does atonement justify forbearance? Many people have never even thought of that and yet consider themselves experts on the doctrine of atonement. I think they are not. It is also one of a supralogical nature. By that I mean it is one that is above human logic. I doubt that any man can actually tell us why there needs to be an atonement until he comes at it in a reverse direction. As we go to the Bible, we find that atonement is a very, very predominant theme in the Old Testament. But if we didn't find that there, I don't know that we would ever understand that man needed what we call atonement. And even if we did, I don't think that we would have any way in the world of figuring out what that atonement could be or should be. The reason I say that is quite simple. Because men who have learned enough of divine revelation through tradition, through misunderstanding of tradition, through folklore that has come down from their forefathers who have turned into error, all of those things have invariably perverted atonement. You won't find those people who have followed it in their blind traditions and followed it accurately. They have all perverted it without an exception. They have perverted it. If it is man's tendency so universally, so generally, to pervert this atonement, it seems obvious that he is not able to rationalize, to reason it out within his own logic. I believe that is because atonement is supralogical, above our logic, and we can never understand it rightly until we get the revelation of it from God. Atonement is a doctrine that demands a posture of humility. Whatever else you may believe about atonement, if you believe that you are capable of just understanding it without any reason to question yourself or to stand in awe and say, "Oh God, teach me, because I know so very little," I question whether you are a good student of the doctrine of atonement. I've been studying it for years, and I must confess that I have many, many questions, perhaps a lot more questions about atonement than I do answers. And I have listened to the many men who will tell you the same thing. Men who can absolutely dazzle your thought process by their intelligent discussion of this doctrine of atonement, and they will immediately confess that they are not authorities on the doctrine of atonement, and that they don't believe there are any authorities, that it is something that has puzzled good men and over which good men have argued and discussed down through the years. The Bible teaches us that a little knowledge, or that knowledge, toughens up. And I believe that's true. You've heard that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and I expect that's true. But it is equally true, if we look at this from a reverse standpoint, that knowledge puffeth up, and a little knowledge puffeth up even more than a great deal of knowledge. A great deal of knowledge, usually, as knowledge continues, as knowledge genuinely develops, especially if some wisdom develops alongside it, it will humble us, because the more we learn about certain things, the more we will realize we do not know. Then we're going to move on from the doctrine of atonement to the doctrine of calling. Now, this doctrine is often called irresistible grace. I expect that that term is so misunderstood today and so maligned that it is not a good term to use in general. It did not mean in its origin what it's intended to mean today, nor did the denial of it mean what most people mean when they deny the doctrine of irresistible grace. But the term was intended as a view of grace from Godward. That is to say, that God is able to move upon any man in such a way to cause him to willingly and freely come to Christ and accept the Lord Jesus Christ. You may not agree with that right on the surface, but when you really begin to delve into it, you'll have a hard time disagreeing with that. And even men who preach heartily against it, as far as a general doctrine, I have often heard confessing by giving the experience of some man being drawn to Christ. When we view this from manward, from the human direction, I think it's much better referred to and much better viewed as effectual calling. That is to say, that God dealt with me in such a way that I willingly and freely came. I wanted to come. I wanted nothing more than to come to the Lord Jesus Christ because of the way God had dealt with me. The objections to this doctrine are actually quite ironic, in that everywhere else in Christendom, people admire the irresistibility of God. For instance, if someone were to say Darius had to have some natural, inherent good in him, otherwise God could never have talked him into doing some of the things for the nation of Judah that he did, he would rise up in objection and say, that's not the God I know. He can do with Darius as he pleases. If I were to say to you, Nebuchadnezzar really, really was a good man deep down. By nature, he was a good man. Otherwise, God could never have changed him into an animal and made him grow claws like an eagle and eat grass like an ox for those 7 years. God could never have done that unless Nebuchadnezzar had been willing for God to make these changes. You'd rise up and say, oh, come on, preacher. Who do you think God is? If I were to say there had to be some inherent good in the Chaldees, because during that period of time that Nebuchadnezzar was out in the pasture grazing like an ox, God did not allow someone to come in and take over his kingdom. God preserved his kingdom for him. But God could never have done that unless there had been some good, godly men among the Chaldees to allow God to do that. He said, come on. God overrode those men, and God did that on his own. You would argue that, even if you disagree with the side of it. So when we begin to look at the objections to so-called irresistible grace, they are indeed quite ironic, because everywhere else they believe in the irresistibility of God. I heard a preacher say, and I believe a good man, but a man who doesn't understand this issue at all, say something to the effect that God's grace is not irresistible. And he went on to say, the only person who I know of who is irresistible is my wife. And I thought, that's such a tragic thing for a man to say something like that, because he has compared the loveliness of his wife. It's as if he has seen the real issue and denied it. He has compared the loveliness of his wife with the loveliness of God, and said, my wife is more lovely than God. You see, it is the loveliness of God that is supposed to be irresistible in this argument. It isn't just the power of God, it is the grace of God. How can grace be irresistible? What? By being graceful. By being extremely graceful. And so the argument there is one that needs to be considered. No matter which way you come from, there are those who believe that it is an issue of God forcing man, but that's not what the doctrine really is. We'll be dealing with that doctrine. And then finally, we will move to the doctrine of preservation and perseverance of the saints. And I mentioned that early. There are those who definitely deny the perseverance of the saints. They do that because they disagree with the Arminian doctrine that men are preserved upon the basis or the condition of their preservation. They are right in that denial, but they're wrong in denying perseverance, because perseverance is not a condition of preservation, but it is rather the result of preservation. And we're going to study the preservation of God, how that God in his providence, in his absolute power, in his unconditional love for his own, preserves his own people under every circumstance. Not only does he preserve them externally, but he preserves them internally. Not only does he keep the circumstances around them, he keeps their heart within them. And because he preserves, they continue on. They persevere, never perfectly, but they do, and we'll be showing you that. This area is greatly wanting in balance as far as teaching is concerned. So this is the direction which we'll be heading in this semester of study. This may at first seem a small scope of subject matter, but in essence, all soteriological theory that has ever been discussed is covered under these headings. I do not profess that I can ably cover or even cover all of these discussions. I'm not well enough educated. I'm not wise enough. But at least we're going to try to approach this in such a direction so as to profit by it. Thank you for your time.